All right. Can everybody hear me all right up there? All right. Well, it's good to be with you today, and I appreciate being here very much. I appreciate these folks going to the effort to organize these kinds of events. It's always good to be able to come and from a far away place and be able to speak and present some of these issues. How many, just so I can kind of get a gauge on where I'm at, how many are familiar with HAARP at all? Okay, so very, very few. I'm going to cover that issue to some degree today. We've got just a couple of hours. I'm going to try and jam a whole lot of information in a very short block of time. I do a lot of work on these issues, mainly through talk radio, and I've done a lot over the last decade. I've worked with 200 radio producers around the world. Most of the media that we get is talk radio in the U.S. and mainstream out of the U.S., which is kind of interesting. The big issues that I want to touch on today, I want to cover the HAARP system, which is a high-frequency active auroral research project operated by the U.S. Navy and Air Force in Alaska, and recently the management of that has been taken by DARPA, which does defense research essentially for the military. The project started in Alaska as an experiment to build a developmental prototype in advance of ground-based Star Wars weapon systems technology that was being contemplated back in the 1980s. The system itself, when it first came up, environmental groups in Alaska really weren't paying too much attention to it. They were looking at the ground disturbance in terms of filling in of wetlands, because the area involved is about 5,000 acres eventually for this full facility. So there was some concern about ground disturbances, but the real issue was what this system was designed to do. And that's what we're going to cover a good deal of this afternoon. When the military first looked at Alaska, there were several things that were driving this project. In terms of missile defense, it was a very controversial issue during the Dole and Clinton elections. In fact, Dole raised this issue at the very end of the campaign, saying, you know, we can do Star Wars, we can do it a lot cheaper because now we can develop this ground-based technology so we don't have to have a totally satellite-based system. And one of the early problems with Star Wars during the Reagan administration was this idea of being able to utilize energy-based weapon systems from low-orbiting space platforms and targeting objects on the ground. That was the original kind of concept. One of the problems was stabilizing satellites. And if anyone's done any carpentry work in the room, you know that when you're a 16th of an inch out on one end and you're going across the room, you start swinging an awful big distance. So when you're dealing with satellites, trying to precision drop a laser or something like this, a particle beam weapon, you need a very narrow band, and you need some accuracy because you don't want to miss your target. So that problem was a big hang-up in the 80s. That was resolved just at the very end of the last century, and there's been a number of media reports about stabilizing satellites. So those have come back into the game. There's a couple of weapons concepts that have been introduced, or military concepts in recent years, that are extremely important to this discussion. One of them is the concept introduced by Bush, which was this idea of preemptive warfare. The idea of, you know, deciding who your enemies are before they do anything and just wiping them out, which we just did in Iraq. That concept is a dangerous concept when you lay on top of it the idea of energy-based weapon systems. And the reason is speed. Energy-based weapon systems, lasers, particle beams, you're dealing with weapons that are delivering their power at 186,300 miles per second in terms of speed, versus conventional delivery systems. Intercontinental ballistic missiles traveling in reentry might make 30,000 miles an hour at optimum speeds. And you've all heard about this defense system that's being developed in Alaska, where they're going to have interceptors shooting down missiles in flight. And it's like the story of the bullet hitting the bullet. If anyone has followed that over the years, there's been some scientists that have walked out of that program saying, you know, it's a setup in terms of what's been designed. These are not real conditions. The likelihood of the system working is pretty remote. Yet, they're spending an awful lot of our money in Alaska today building this system. If you've watched the news in the last week, there were some Russian exercises of new missile systems that actually, on reentry, the whole idea is you've got a straight trajectory that you can predict. Now they have a way to alter in flight those incoming ICBMs, which make the system we're just beginning to build in Alaska already obsolete. The real system will most likely be an energy-based weapon system. When you see the movement of China in space, it's not about going to the moon. It's about maintaining some balance in space. And war is moving from the ground to these low-orbiting space platforms. Now, one of the problems with those is energy, and this is where HAARP starts to come into the picture, and we'll talk a lot about that as we go on. The idea of energizing these platforms, providing energy to them in low orbits where the orbits degrade rather rapidly. You want to be able to keep them up, so you got to have a fuel source. And one of the original concepts was maybe we can tap some energy out of the ionosphere, this layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, extends for a couple hundred miles out, that we could tap this layer, pull energy out of this layer, and use this in these weapon systems, in these weapon system developments. One of the other ideas that started back in the 60s was the idea of maybe we can take energy, convert it to some other form, wirelessly send it to these orbiting space platforms and cause them to be energized. But the technology for receiving and sending that kind of focused energy really wasn't there in the 60s. The same scientists involved in that work are now at the University of Alaska Fairbanks doing work using the systems that have been developed at HAARP. And what HAARP is essentially a phased array, an antenna field. If you were to look at it today, you'll see 48 antenna masts, 72 feet high, and then across a dipole. So it looks like a big field of antennas. And what happens with those, they produce radio frequency energy. And what they do is they concentrate that energy. If you think about radio frequency energy, and anyone that's studied physics knows the basic rule is as you come off of those antennas, off of those sources, the energy spreads out very rapidly, becomes increasingly less and less dense or concentrated. So eventually, as you get away from these radio transmitters, your energy decreases, the sound signal decreases, and eventually you don't hear the station anymore. In this case, by firing the antennas in a very specific way, they create what's called a cyclotron resonance, where that energy is actually focused or concentrated in a, by analogy, in a similar way to a laser concentrating light, because it follows that same rule. As the energy comes off of a flashlight and you shine it on the wall, you get this huge beam that gets wider and wider with distance, whereas a laser keeps it compact and tight. By analogy, the same idea was applied to the development of the HAARP technology. Now, the person that originated the patents was a guy named Dr. Bernard Eastland, who did a lot of work for the military. He did a lot of work in nuclear programs back in the 50s and 60s. We've kept a pretty good dialogue with Ben Eastland. In fact, I had dinner with him in San Diego a couple weeks ago, talking about sort of where this technology has gone and where it's going. The thing that happened with Eastland is he was working independently as a researcher, and he came up with this concept that if we could figure out how to focus this energy into the ionosphere, specifically into the magnetic field lines, that maybe we could utilize the Earth's natural magnetic field lines as part of this weapons technology. And so what Eastland developed was this concept, and he actually achieved a number of patents on the concept. They're cited in our book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, and they're also on my website, and there's a lot of articles on this that you're welcome to pull down from the website. It's earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com. In that, what Bernard basically did is he approached Atlantic Richfield, which was one of the largest oil and gas producers in Alaska at the time, with huge reserves at that point, in proven reserves, over 4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and no market for that gas. In fact, many of you are aware of this whole debate about gas pipeline coming out of Alaska to bring natural gas to Lower 48. In all the years that we've had the North Slope oil fields, that gas has been reinjected back into the field, keeping the field pressurized until markets could be found for that gas. Well, ARCO, looking at it, said, you know, what can we do with the gas right where we're at? And what Bernard had developed, Dr. Eastland had developed, was this idea that if we could pump energy in to these magnetic field lines in a very specific way, that they would act as wave guides. And so when you think about this, most of you are familiar with those illustrations of those magnetic field lines coming out of the South Pole, wrapping around, getting their furthest distance at the equator, and then wrapping back into the northern regions of the world. And this is depicted in a lot of illustrations in terms of what happens with energy in the planet. What they've done is mapped these magnetic field lines, and they found that the natural flow from south to north, if you pump energy in using this type of transmitter, the energy will, like, if you could visualize, it would be like a corkscrewing motion forming around those magnetic field lines moving from north to south. And the idea was that by using those, the natural components of the earth as part of this machine on the ground, that any object passing through this energy field would be disrupted electronically. So this was the idea of creating a global shield for intercontinental ballistics missiles, which was the original concept of Dr. Eastland when he first fielded this issue. One of the principal people that he took this to was a guy named Ramos, who was one of the founders of TRW and one of the initiators of Star Wars during the Reagan administration. And this was one of those missing links. When he saw the first view graphs and illustrations, Bernard said it best. He said that he immediately recognized the potency of it, expanded the ideas, and they jointly filed an additional patent. That then began to drive the research. And the first research done was done by a subsidiary that Bernard formed, which was called Arco Power Technologies, Inc. $30 million a year company, small subsidiary, 25 employees at the time, mostly lobbyists in Washington, D.C. looking for money from military planners. And the first thing they did is test this idea of sending energy wirelessly into a low-orbiting space platform. It was written up in Aviation Weekly. The dates of the site are in articles on the web as well as the book. But this idea of sending energy up was the first thing that caught the military's attention because they were able to demonstrate the practicality of it with a small-scale system in Canada. The next thing that came up was the idea that this had a lot of versatility as an instrument, potentially, because if you are able to manipulate the conditions of the ionosphere, which is responsible for lots of the stability of communications, when it's disturbed, communications are disturbed globally. So understanding the ionosphere has been a long area of research for military. Controlling the ionosphere is the issue of HAARP. How to control the conditions there to either interfere with communications of an adversary or be able to maintain, while you're doing that interference, your own communication system. So that was another sort of attribute of HAARP, was this idea of being something that could be used to disrupt communications within a battle environment while at the same time maintaining your own, which for most people that study these things, this is a major issue for militaries. The next thing that came up that was kind of interesting was a concept called earth-penetrating tomography. Simple analogy, looking into the earth, or by analogy would be like x-raying the earth. Only in this case, using radio frequency energy. And essentially what happens is this is a high-frequency transmitter, first of all. So it's got a very narrow band of primary operation in terms of how it works. But the way they can pulse it and modulate that signal, they can create basically effects within what's called 16 decades of frequency. From ultra-low frequency to visible light, they can affect this whole band in different ways by manipulating the instrument on the ground. Well, one of the things they found early on in research, even prior to HAARP, was research being done in Europe, was the idea that if you pump energy into the ionosphere in an extremely low frequency range, an ELF range, which is between, in the case of HAARP, between 1 and 100 hertz is the operating range for creating this earth-penetrating tomography application particularly. What they found is that the ionosphere changes from being a direct current to an oscillating current, changes its character. So it begins to pulse with the pulse rate of the signal coming off the ground in harmony with it. And they actually tried this in Europe with a system called IZICAT, and they actually caused the ionosphere to pulse to the sound of Wagner, as an example. A big change, you know, in terms of what they were doing. They thought it was kind of neat, but what you end up with is a lot of specialists looking at only one aspect of what they're doing, not considering where other areas. You know, the thing about this college that I like is the multidisciplinary approach that people take to the sciences, which is really the right approach. In military research, it's compartmentalized, segregated, and separated, so one discipline never knows what the other is doing in most cases, and a lot is lost between the physicists and the living scientists, the biologists, electrophysiologists, people who are interested in life sciences versus just the physics of these things. And I think that separation has really caused a lot of problems in terms of industrial development in the United States. If you compare it to what was going on in the Soviet Union, they used the opposite approach, multidisciplinary teams. They got a lot more bang for the buck, a lot more lateral thinking, a lot more produced in terms of intellectual outcomes for a lot less money. It was the way they kept up, quite frankly, was multidisciplinary teams. It's also the way they developed their standards for instance, electromagnetic exposures of various kinds. In some instances, are 1,000 times more stringent than U.S. standards. That's a pretty significant thing when you start to think about what's safe and what isn't and who's making those decisions in the United States. With HARP, the idea of earth-penetrating tomography became pretty interesting. And in fact, in 1996, under the military's defense budget, it was funded that year under non-proliferation and counter-proliferation, is where HARP appears in the budget. Because the Senate said at that time, it was right after Gulf War I, I guess we can call it, and they were real interested in finding underground facilities. And this issue became a primary issue. If we had a technology that could go in and get a scan a couple kilometers deep to see what underground facilities, shelters, mineral stratas existed there, that we might be able to locate these facilities. So it was funded as a priority, and they wouldn't get any more funding until they proved that. And there was a guy named Papadopoulos from the University of Maryland who was involved in this research. He was interviewed on BBC TV on a show called Horizons. And what he said is that when they ran this test, that they had statistically a 99.9% accuracy, which is about as good as it gets, in locating the exact perimeters of an underground mining facility, tunnels and the like, where they knew, you know, they knew by surveys exactly where everything was, and they were able to compare the data that they developed using using the HARP system essentially to create this effect. What they're able to do is get pretty clear imaging. In fact, it came up again right after 9/11. MSNBC in November of 2001, I think it was November 27th, actually ran a story, and it was a story about utilizing HARP for earth-penetrating tomography for this idea of looking into the earth in Afghanistan, and then, of course, it came up again in Iraq. The thing is, it's just one system for ground imaging. If you watch the wars in these last two situations, most of the war was fought at night. It's as visible to us as the day when you really start looking at the type of sensors that are available to militaries today. And that, not just the terror effect of bombing people in the middle of the night, but the idea that you can get good, clear imaging. Underground, you can even differentiate a half a degree temperature differential, so you can start to sort out the human bodies from hardware, not using a HARP system, but using other kinds of sensors that are available to militaries today. So you get a lot of things, seismic sensors, ground-penetrating tomography, heat sensors, a lot of different imaging-type sensors that give you some depth of penetration. The other thing that comes up when you start talking about extremely low-frequency signals is this idea that maybe there might be other effects. And one of the things that comes up is the effect on human health. And ELFs, extremely low-frequency signals, got a lot of controversy back in the 70s. Many may remember this controversy of these transmitters used for communication with submarines. They were using a very low frequency, very long wavelengths, and so they buried 14 to 26 mile antennas in Michigan and Wisconsin, this area of the country. And it created a lot of controversy. People were saying there's health effects, there's problems with this. You know, these kinds of transmitters have been buried basically because you need these long wavelengths to penetrate the earth and sea for communication with submarines, as an example. Short wavelengths do not penetrate deep enough. The problem comes in with what other effects occur with ELF. And one of the things that shows up, and this is where the physicists lose sight of the life science, there's been a tremendous amount of work in external fields, non-ionizing radiation, low levels of energy, having tremendous effects physiologically. And in the past, go back 20 years, there's a lot of controversy about this. There's still a lot of controversy because a few of the guys from the old school are still around that are still fighting this battle, saying low levels of energy are pretty much transparent to the body. What has been discovered is that there are very specific window frequencies that can have tremendous impact on the human body. There was a study done, for instance, University of Utah in 1985, and it produced for the Air Force a book called the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook. And you can get it, it's a public document, and it basically gives you the radio frequency dosages for affecting liver, kidneys, lungs, heart, basically to override the natural operation of those organs and cause them to malfunction, degrading the ability of people to engage in combat, as an example. This is part of that sort of initiative for non-lethal kind of weapons, looking at other instabilities that can be created in the body or in hardware that doesn't require bombs, bullets, and the normal ripping of tissue that all of us have seen in warfare. It's changing to a warfare that's CNN compatible. It doesn't create the same kind of visual images. And that is a big issue for military planners. The images that come back from the battlefield change the public opinion about what we're doing in many instances. But if you can create situations where the apparent of destruction is not so obvious, people tend to take a little different view of it. The other thing that's happened that's changed military is we are removing ourselves further and further from the battlefield in terms of what kind of damage we can inflict, almost like running video games today. A lot of things are done at a distance. Changes the dimension of warfare, because when you're doing it from a distance, the same emotional effects are not there. You're engaged in a battle, but it's sort of removed. You come back from that battle, yeah, you have feelings about all that, but you're not looking in the whites of the eyes of the people that you're killing, so you come back with a much different attitude. It becomes easier and easier to fight wars when you don't have to see your enemy. And I think this is one of the additional problems beyond preemptive warfare, is this idea of distancing ourselves from the human dimension of warfare, which is the dimension that caused our fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers to return from war and say, I don't want my kids and the next generation going there. And they do everything they can to avoid it, and that's changing. Preemptive warfare is the wrong direction of that change. The thing that came up with HAARP that was pretty interesting from my perspective is the lack of coverage. And part of it was the environmental community's recognition of energy, not in the form of oil and gas, but energy being utilized to manipulate environmental or human factors. When you talk about the human body, do you remember a few years ago, this was probably now 5 or 6 years ago, there was a story in Japan about a bunch of children watching a cartoon on television, and the flicker rate of the light caused 700 of them to go to hospitals with epileptic seizures. Now, so I see some nods, so I know some people have remembered that story. Now, everyone will tell you, in the scientific community, almost everyone will tell you, it's, you know, light emitted from a television set is harmless, you know. The fact of the matter is, generally speaking, that's true, but if you can maintain a specific pulse rate at a specific rhythm within one of these window frequencies, you can cause huge changes biologically within the body. This is the base of research for the development of a whole new array of weapons that fall into this general category that the military now refers to this whole movement as a revolution of military affairs. Today they're actually referring to it now as a revolution of military and political affairs, and they equate it to the introduction of gunpowder in the Middle Ages in terms of its effect in Europe and warfare and the way it changed, or atomic weapons in the last century. That's what's happening now. And when you hear Rumsfeld and others start to talk about these new systems, these energy-based systems, that's what he's talking about. It's energy systems that discharge at tremendous velocity with incredible power. And this is being developed by not just our military. If you look at the public reports have been released from the intelligence committees of our U.S. Senate, you see sweeping reports on China's efforts in this area. And you hear our mainstream media discount those efforts, saying, well, Chinese spend only $40 billion a year on military. We're spending $400 billion a year. It's not a problem. You get a lot more for your buck in China. $40 billion in China probably in output produces twice what we produce in real output, hardware on the other end of the production line. It's not to be underestimated. In fact, when you look at genius as it spreads across populations, the likelihood of China developing the level of genius necessary and then through a centralized system pulling that genius into military programs is got a lot higher probability than in the West. At the same time, ideologically, what has happened? We all talk about, oh, this is wonderful, we have all this trade. That trade is predicated on a difference in philosophy at the root. The Chinese knew they could not get their production kicked in gear. You know, you convert a factory today from producing electronic boards to computers to producing electronic boards for missiles by just loading in new software. It's not like it was in World War II where you spent 6 or 8 months or even a year sometimes reconverting a plant. You can do it very quickly and very efficiently today. What happened in Soviet Russia, we didn't supply them the weapons, but our financial institutions, people like Arm & Hammer and others, went over and we built their industrial capacity. We made sure they had factories and we made sure they had the ability to produce iron and steel, but we didn't tell them how to build the bomb, but we gave them the infrastructure to do it. We're doing the same thing in China today based on trade and how we relate to trade. At the same time, they take, and according to Senate intelligence reports, this sort of long view of the world. And there's a lot of patience We look at things in the U.S. quarter to quarter, you know, for whatever reasons are driving that sort of short-sightedness. This long view takes a much different position, and it results in a much different direction. When you start adding in these other factors and these changes in the way we look at war, all of this becomes extremely relevant. The idea, consider the idea of modifying the ionosphere, a natural component that essentially screens out lots of energy that would otherwise make life impossible on the planet. It's a very important thing. When you think of ozone depletion, that's a problem. When you think about interference with ionospheric activity, that may or may not become even a bigger problem, depending on what happens. So the military says, it's a big system, you know, there's a lot of energy there. We're just, you know, we're a grain of sand on the beach. The difference is we're using coherent rhythmic energy that's designed to do specific things. If you look at early work done at Stanford University on the ionosphere, and if you look at the ionosphere above it, the magnetosphere, where those two couple, where they come together, and many of you remember this from the books. So you'll see the Earth, and you see this ionosphere, and then you see the magnetosphere, and then you see the magnetotail, which kind of whips back behind, and it's sort of the energy blow-off as it comes around the planet. The interactions, the interference with that is what this is all about. And what they found at Stanford is that if they pumped energy in a very specific frequency in the VLF range, it actually, when it hit this upper area of the ionosphere, the signal amplified 1,000 times. Now that's significant stuff, because you're talking about taking an analogy would be like the primer on a bullet. You know, it's a little bit of energy release that releases the larger amount of energy in the gunpowder. The same is true here. Utilizing instruments on the ground and finding those areas of instability that can be triggered artificially, you then create a way to tap that energy in a way that becomes weapons applicable. And that's what HAARP is all about. When DARPA took it over, they have 2 years. They took it over this last year. They have 2 years in which they're going to take that 48 antenna array and move it to 180 and increase the power by 400%. Now, that's still only half of where they want to go. Eventually, what they want out of this system, according to their own documents, is 1 billion watts of effective radiated power. Now, that's not the input power. That's the effective radiated power. That includes these capitalizations of these instabilities as well. But 1 billion watts, think about that. I mean, think about the average household light bulb at 60. Just to put it in perspective, the biggest radio stations in the country, I think, today are around 50,000 watts. I think there's still a couple of those around. There might even be one or two larger ones. But you're talking 1 billion watts. Now, what they found, going back to this story in Japan, where the light flicker caused this effect with all these kids having epileptic seizures, what was that about? They maintained a coherent signal, a flicker rate that was within that window frequency for a long enough period of time to trigger chemical reactions within the brain. You know, and the work in this area goes a lot further. When you start to look at what has been discovered is that external oscillating fields within specific frequencies can create this same thing, whether it's flickering light, or they can create the same effect using what's called binaural beat. It was invented in the 1960s. Sound, we can't hear these really low frequency sounds. We can't hear down that low. Our ears aren't set up for that. So what they did is they developed a technique where they send in a sound signal, say at 17,000 hertz or cycles per second or pulses per second in one ear, and they send in one, say, at 17,007. They cross, they cancel, and they leave a beat frequency of 7, the difference between 17,000 and 17,007. That beat frequency is set up in the brain, and if you looked at the brain on an EEG at that moment, you would see brain coherence, both hemispheres pulsing in unison to that pulse rate. And for some applications, kind of interesting, you know, for accelerated learning as an example, to be able to put your brain into that ideal band for learning, for absorbing information. There's instruments that have been developed for that. There's things that have been developed for increasing meditation capacity, relaxation, lots of things for altering brain activity using either light or sound as examples. You can also use electricity, electromagnetic fields. I do a workshop where I actually demonstrate a bunch of this, and I think Leon might have caught part of that when I was in this area last. But with that, electromagnetic fields, they actually have electrocranial stimulation, which they use, again, for altering brain activity for specific applications. And these are things used not by militaries, but in the civilian sector. What the military looked at is, okay, if we can create these kinds of reactions, can we enhance our troops' performance, and at the same time, can we use these kinds of concepts for degrading our adversaries' performance? And from that, in the 80s, became this huge effort for creating non-lethal weapon systems that would do that. If you remember a few years ago, the one that the Marines announced, and it looks like a big dish mounted on a Humvee. And the story was that it was for riot control and that they would hit people with this microwave energy and it would create the sensation of heat on the surface of the skin so you'd feel like about 130 degrees temperature sensations. Wouldn't create burning unless it was improperly ranged. I mean, if you're ranging it for a mile and someone walks 10 feet in front of it, you got other problems because of the energy densities that are involved. But this was the idea, you know, that you would be able to heat people up, you know, and get crowds to disperse and so on. You know, the last time burning people was used was about 500 years ago, and we decided burning people at the stake wasn't such a humane idea. And here we are bringing the very concept back. What they didn't say is that by altering that device in terms of energy density, waveform, pulse rate, any number of parameters, you can create much, much different effects. Those effects they well understand because they've had those effects analyzed. In other words, they have figured it out. This radio frequency dosimetry handbook was developed based on earlier work that was done. It was a technical document, and it was called Low Intensity Conflict in Modern Technology, 1984, Maxwell Air Force Base. And what this laid out was sort of these anomalous things in human physiology where they found this non-ionizing low levels of energy could create these dramatic effects in the body and in the brain. When you go back even further in history, if you go back to 1969, there was a book called Unless Peace Comes. And within that book was a chapter called How to Wreck Your Environment. Now, this is before Earth Day, so you could get away with a chapter title like that, and it was taken fairly well. In fact, the concept was that chapter was written by G.F. Gordon MacDonald. He was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson when he was president. He was also a professor at UCLA. And what he said back in 1969, he said, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal to the Earth that would have an impact on the emotional state of human beings underneath that field. That's pretty interesting. Didn't have the technology in 1969. By the time HARP came around, that technology is in fact there. This is one of the side effects that have been recognized by Russian scientists when the Russian Duma, about I think it was August 11th, 2002. It might have been the 9th. I'm usually pretty good on that stuff, but you can check either one. If you look at Pravda and who is it? The Interfax News Agency did a press release on this. And they actually came forward and said the very things that we had expressed concern about regarding HARP and its effect on human physiology, their scientists finally came forward, objected on the same grounds, along with the environmental impacts and other impacts, and came forward. They passed a resolution. That came actually 3 years after a resolution of a similar nature was passed in the European Parliament that we had a lot to do with. We had been invited over. This is interesting because how politics works on this in Europe is so much different than what happens here in the U.S. The first people that contacted us on HARP in Europe was a gentleman by the name of Tom Spencer. He was a conservative in the European Parliament. At that time, he was chair of the Environmental Committee. You know, that kind of doesn't fit, you know, in terms of how we think of environmentalism in the U.S., a conservative chairing the committee. But in Europe, they've progressed beyond where we have, where we're just seeing the U.S. start to recognize environmentalism as something that's relevant to everyone who breathes, regardless of your political affiliation. Tom, then, he brought us over. We brought a number of documents with us. You know, just as an example, how he found us. You know, that's an interesting story. Someone just like you heard us on radio talking about this issue, got our book, sent it to him. They're all marked up copy. He read it, called us, went back to his scientists in Great Britain and said, what's the story on this? And he kept getting this answer. Stay away from it. You don't want to get involved. And Tom Spencer's a unique kind of politician. For him, that was the ticket to the dance. You know, it's like that's why he got involved. What happened in the interim is we made several trips over. He set up forums for us to present. We delivered probably 300 documents, non-classified documents that were publicly available, and that began to set the stage for the debate. In the interim, we'd gotten contacted by the Greens in the European Parliament, And we asked him, are you working with Tom Spence? No, he's not interested in these issues, you know, from his perspective. He's pro-military, blah, blah, blah. So no, you need to talk with him. That was the beginning of a coalition between the Greens and the conservatives on this issue. The next thing that happened is we made a trip over and we pulled the Social Democrats in. And this became part of a security and disarmament resolution that was a multi-page resolution, voted on paragraph by paragraph. In our section specifically dealing with HAARP, were passed by the largest margins. And, you know, in all of that, I'll give you the citation. It's a European Parliament resolution, A4005/99. And what happened in this is, going back, we first talked about it with Tom. We brought the information in. He ran it by his scientists. That brought in a whole lot of other people to the discussion. We then began to set up a strategy for how would we introduce this concept and tie into this concept the non-lethal weapons technologies that were emerging very rapidly in the U.S. and being pushed on our allies in Europe. So Tom and I ended up in this conference. It was a group called GLOBE, and it's 200 legislators from 44 governments, the top environmental legislators in the world. He gave us an opportunity to present to that group when he was their executive director or their president, whatever their top position was there. Coming out of that, we ended up in a conference with him called Religion, Science, and the Environment. It was sponsored by Bartholomew I, which is called the Green Patriarch, for those that don't know him. He came out a number of years ago and declared environmental degradation as a sin for the Orthodox people, representing 200 million across the world. A big, you know, shift in way thinking was done. But he developed environmental conferences. Tom and I were in one of those for 12 days together, and we laid out a strategy for bringing this issue into the European Parliament. And the strategy was we were going to debate NATO. They were going to bring NATO in. Tom, in the interim, became foreign affairs chairman, very powerful position in the European Parliament. He went to the Secretary General, said, you know, would you please come and present NATO's position on non-lethal weapons and their deployment in Europe, as well as ionospheric modification for weapons use. And NATO basically said, we have no policy on either and we're not coming. So he went to the American mission, which is responsible for what's going on with HAARP, and the American mission refused to produce anyone. And this really angered this committee, because this is the same committee NATO had gone to sometime before and said, hey, we want to bring in new member states, and we need your buy-in. So they were very important to NATO at that point, but when they had an issue for NATO, NATO wasn't interested in participating. What happened is, the night before the hearing, that committee put together a closed meeting, and it was involved myself, a member from the International Red Cross, a person from the group GRIP, based in Brussels, and a woman, Rosalie Bertel, who is an environmentalist, a physician, and a physicist from Canada, on our side of the equation, and two members of the European media. We met with the committee for 5 hours in closed session to give them the overview of what this was about. We demonstrated for them an infrasound device that's used and referenced in the literature in terms of non-lethal weapons, so we were able to demonstrate something that they had only heard rumor about, something that had actually been built and was demonstrable. At the end of that, we went in then the next day into the hearing. I was supposed to have 15 minutes. They gave me an hour and a half to present. NATO was in the back of the room, not participating actively in the hearing, and we opened with a document called Ionospheric Modification for Weapons Application Produced by NATO France. And this is, remember, NATO said they don't have any policy on all of this. We then introduced documents from the Strategic Studies Institute in Great Britain showing the deployment and of non-lethal weapons throughout NATO Europe. Again, NATO saying they had no policy guidelines for any of it. And our suggestion to the European Parliament was engaging in these initiatives without policy guidance was as reckless as you could possibly get. 8 months later, they developed their non-lethal weapons policies. The ionospheric modification policies, to my knowledge, have never been developed. Coming out of that hearing, Santer's science and technology aide came to me and said they would pursue this, they would do a study, and they did. That study was completed, but it involved more than HAARP. They dealt with everything, creating electromagnetic fields from toaster ovens to intercontinental ballistic missiles. I mean, everything in between. They took a look at the literature, a literature overview, which began to set the stage to start to look at treaty dialogues surrounding these kinds of energy-based weapon systems. In HAARP, one of the things that came up is, you know, can you really affect emotional states of individuals with these external fields? And the answer is yes, you can. In fact, if you go back even back into the early days of these concepts. You can go back to Zbigniew Brzezinski's work when he was at Columbia University. He wrote a book called Between Two Ages, which I really recommend you find. I'm sure there's a library that has it. It published over 170,000 copies. It's around. This book was looking at technology and its impact on globalization and what was going on in the world from a viewpoint in the early 1970s. This is before Brzezinski became the National Security Advisor to President Carter, just to keep that all in perspective, who this guy was and what he was saying. And in the early 70s, he made a prediction. And if you read this book, it is a book of predictions about what would happen in Europe, Africa, South America, Asia, in terms of the dissolution of the Iron Curtain, all of the things economically, socially, that have happened in the last 30 years. If you read this book today, you would swear it was a history and not a prediction, because he was dead on accurate. He writes in a very convoluted style, but it's well worth the read. But in that book, Between Two Ages, between pages 54 and 58, you'll see this little discussion about J.F. Gordon McDonald's ideas about affecting the ionosphere in a way that would influence behavior. And this is what Brzezinski essentially said: is you could change the emotional state of large segments of the population, creating either aggression or passive sorts of behavior, and you could do it with virtually no one's knowledge using this kind of a system. And what he said, which is very important from someone involved in policymaking in this country, what he said was that no matter who is in power, liberal or conservative, the temptation to use that type of technology to further their political ends would be greater than the good sense to restrain. And I'm paraphrasing the quote, but that's essentially the essence of it. You know, the idea that, you know, could we do this? In fact, if you look at it's either May 24th or 25th, 2002, The Economist, well-known publication in terms of economic issues and some social issues. The cover story on that is on mind control, manipulation of the human brain using chemical and electromagnetic means. And it's an ethical article about the ethics of doing this. The book Earth Rising, The Revolution, we took that subject a lot further away from the HARP concepts and started looking at what's all involved in that. And my background, I have a doctorate in traditional complementary medicine. My area of interest was electrophysiology, the effect of electromagnetic fields on the body, which is what got me interested in this in the very first place. Because here we were working with huge amounts of energy in ways that I know from my own work and my own research can be dramatic in terms of their effect if they inadvertently hit these window frequencies that cause these kinds of changes within our physiology. When you look at the direction of the technology, there's over three dozen patents that we cite in this book, Earth Rising, The Revolution. This book has 650 citations. The book, the first book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, had 350, and our latest had 350. These were pulled from 20,000 within our archives, documents that are reasonably classified in terms of laid out, and probably 200,000 documents that were pitched before we archived the material. So it's a lot. It represents 10 years of my work and another 5 years of another individual's work consolidating that information down. And we add probably 200 documents a month to our archives at this point. In that, what came out was this trend, this general trend of affecting human beings without long-lasting damage. In other words, it's easier to clean up the mess afterwards, is really what it boils down to. And so systems were developed to affect in three areas: affect human beings, affect hardware, equipment, computers, etc., or affect human beings and hardware by the same instrument. These three concepts show up in Chinese military journals, shows up in Russian military journals, and shows up in our own. One in particular I'd point to is an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. It was produced by a publication called Perimeters, which is produced by the U.S. Army War College. So it's easy to find on the web. Hopefully it's still on the web, but certainly you can find it in good libraries. This article was a discussion of how to affect the human brain in a way that degrades our performance for military applications, and was a review of the literature on that subject. And one of the things that they said, and I'll just read this quote, because I think it's one that draws this into some perspective. And this is among many different bullet points about how energy can be used to affect living organisms. But the one that in particular of interest is a psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal. In other words, what they're saying is any of these systems can be used for transferring the necessary energy at the in the necessary form to affect behavior. Now, this was actually a focus of a story on February 5th or February 7th, 1999, and it was a show called Undercurrents. It's on CBC TV, Canadian Broadcasting, their public television, where they interviewed myself. They interviewed a guy named Persinger, who's a specialist in this area of manipulation of human brains using energy in Canada. He's done a lot of work for, he works at Laurentian University, he's done a lot of work for military in the U.S. The other was a guy named Smirnov, who works for the, it was the Institute of Psychocorrection in Moscow, which he developed a technology that was actually demonstrated that would influence behavior in a similar way. The others that were interviewed were the Morrises, which were two people that were responsible for bringing to the, with decline to the Reagan administration, this concept of non-lethal energy-based weapons. They could not talk about what was being done in the U.S., but they could talk about their experiences in the former Soviet Union and working with scientists there, and they did. And essentially what they all basically said was, This can all be done. You can use these various means to transfer a signal, and this becomes disconcerting in a lot of different ways. I mean, the Morris's position was, knowing this, the U.S. government should be aggressive in taking the position that on electronic devices that can be used to input that kind of a signal, you can actually put a circuit within those electronic devices to screen those out so that those carriers are not effective in bringing that kind of signal in. But that's not the kind of dialogue when it comes to computers and government that we normally hear about. We hear about other things like how to get into your computer to see what's going on without you knowing about it. The problem with a lot of this is it pushes the envelope. And when we did the chapter on manipulation of the human brain as an example, there's over 100 citations. Most of them are military journals, academic studies. There's a few mainstream media reports in there. But the bulk of it are academic studies showing how all of that actually works. The interesting thing, going back to HAARP again, is here's a system that finally comes into play that can do exactly what J.F. Gordon MacDonald predicted in 69 and Brzezinski spoke about in the early 70s. It can electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way. Now we've got to roll back a little bit. Let's talk about how much energy does it really take. There was a guy named Jose Delgado. Does anybody know the name Jose Delgado in the room? Wow, just a couple. Jose Delgado got his degree in electrophysiology, University of Madrid, 1950. Most people don't even know such a degree existed in 1950, but it did. He came to the United States in the mid-60s. He worked at Yale University, and his area of specialty was the brain. And initially, his job was to map the brain, the various portions of the brain that were responsible for the various functions of our intellect and controlling the body. So he began to do that using primates and humans, using implants to stimulate electrically these various portions of the brain, see what would happen. And he actually, he wrote a book. It's called Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society, because his view of the world was, wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate the behavior of people over large areas so they would all be happy? As an example. You know, and actually somebody asked me that in a lecture a number of years ago. You know, wouldn't that be great? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, the fact of the matter is human beings are meant to experience the full range of human emotions. That is who we are. To manipulate that in any way externally is a huge step in the very wrong direction. In fact, you know, that whole concept, you know, the toughest group to convince of the reality of that concept are politicians, because they don't want to stand up and say something that someone's going to criticize them over. And this is what the European Parliament did as a result of the research we provided to them. In the last section, after dealing with HAARP, they then dealt with this broader issue of manipulation of human beings. And this is what the resolution calls for in this particular paragraph. It calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings. Unquote. That is an extremely important step along this road. The idea that journals like The Economist, Psychology Today, are beginning to discuss the ethics of manipulating human behavior. Think about the basic fundamental freedoms of the United States. Religion, assembly, speech, what is that all about? It's about what goes on in here. If they were to any concept in our founding fathers about what we really need in that, and the idea that you could actually manipulate what went on in the human brain, that would have probably been the very first thing cited in the First Amendment, because that really is the most important issue to let all those other things happen. Now we are at a point where our technology has taken us to a place that we can manipulate what happens within the human brain in terms of general emotional state. And Delgado, what he did in the 60s with implants, one of the most dramatic examples was he had a charging bull running towards him, and he flips a switch, and it affects part of the brain, and the bull stops in its tracks. If you get towards a psycho-civilized society, and you can find it in good libraries, you'll see the actual photographs of that particular test. But this is primitive compared to what emerged in the 70s and 80s. By the mid-80s, Delgado had figured out that you could affect the brain in the same way with nothing implanted and no physical contact to the body at all, using radio frequency energy in a very specific window frequency at 1/50th of the energy concentration that the Earth naturally produces. And let me put that in perspective. Today, where we're sitting, there's between 100 and 200 million times more radio frequency energy surrounding us than the Earth naturally produces, based on what mankind has done in the last 100 years. So when you talk about 1/50th of what the Earth produces, you know, you're talking about a very, very little bit of energy. And what he found was that by directing that energy at a specific person or primate, they could flip their emotional state from highly passive and lethargic to highly aggressive and active, like flipping on and off a light switch. Real dramatic tests in the mid-80s. That began to trigger a huge movement in the military's perspective as what can we do with small amounts of energy that have maybe smaller delivery systems where we can affect limited numbers of people with this kind of technology. And you'll see, and many have seen some of the sort of reports that pop up periodically. You'll see something on 60 Minutes dealing with, there was one that ran that dealt with affecting people, gave them flu-like symptoms, interfered with their equilibrium. So they would get nauseous, they couldn't fight, obviously. They're throwing up and doing all the things that happen to a person when they have the flu. The thing that began to transition in all of this was, well, you know, this is CNN appropriate. You know, you don't see it, you can disperse a crowd, you can do all kinds of things, and yet you don't necessarily kill anyone. And this is a misnomer as well, something that came up in the hearings in the European Parliament by the International Red Cross. At that time, in 98, when we did the hearing, which resulted in a resolution in 99, what was said was, you know, the idea that you could manipulate people, that you could create these kinds of effects, and that there was really no regulation on it. You know, even the chemical and biological treaties were cited in that discussion, you know, the ones that had been recently signed at that point, because they provided for certain latitudes. One of them was whatever you did in your own country was fine. It was exempt. In other words, a chemical that you could not use against a declared enemy, you get to use at home. And we saw the results of that in Moscow when over 100 people died in a theater with a compound that would never have been permitted against their declared enemies. Our treaties, almost every one of our treaties, allow for exemptions for domestic use. And yet you don't see parallel legislation. I mean, if something's not good enough for our adversaries, I would suggest that it's not something we should use at home. And there ought to be parallel legislation running right up alongside it. What many people don't recognize is that the idea of interfering with the environment using external means, that could really be there. You know, there's a treaty that goes back to when we ratified it in 1978, and the actual treaty dialogue began in 1971, and it's a treaty that deals with environmental manipulation and forbids it. And the people that led the charge on that treaty was essentially the United States and the former Soviet Union, when by the early 70s they had realized that they could manipulate these factors without ability to model the outcomes, because we still can't model the outcomes, you know, in terms of what we do. We can punch energy in and we can sort of hope that it all goes right. A good example of this is coincidentally, above the HAARP facility, there was a dog leg in the jet stream, where the jet stream's kind of cruising along, moves north 50 miles, moves east 75 miles, more or less, and then drops back south 50 miles and moves on its course. You'll see this in the May issue of Scientific America. It was either 2000 or 2001, but the whole issue was dedicated to weather. And if you look in the middle section, you'll see a map of Alaska, and you'll see this little anomaly. It happens to be coincidentally right above the HARP facility. But what that anomaly did in Alaska is it moved storm fronts out of East Texas and Louisiana into Central Florida and dropped a couple of tornadoes in Orlando, according to Scientific America. You remember that story a few years back? Now, some people said it was HARP, and I went, no, you know, there's no evidence of that because there's no independent monitoring, but could that be? And the answer is, yeah, it could be, and here's how it works. The way they used to look at these instruments, they used to call them ionospheric heaters because they could heat the ionosphere in certain applications. And what you would see, if you could see it, would be above the HARP facility would be like a 30-mile diameter disk, and then from that disk, pushing it out, creating a column where the lower atmosphere then moves into that space to fill up what's been removed. And so essentially what happens in that is pressure systems change. If you have jet streams in the vicinity, you can alter their course. The very things that's come up in the HARP planning documents in terms of manipulation of weather systems, as well as comes up in the Russian literature or the earlier Soviet literature for manipulating weather systems. And weather modification is where that treaty in the early 70s began, because the Russians were doing a lot of work, we were doing a lot of work in this area, and we had all crossed this threshold where we went, ooh, we just might totally screw this place up in a way that was more threatening at that time than the nuclear issues, which didn't result in the same kinds of agreements as aggressively as that one did. The thing that comes up later, and this is important when you talk about manipulation of environmental factors, is, you know, a lot of it becomes a little bit squishy until you start to look at what some of the big policymakers in the country are saying. This is a quote from Defense Secretary William Cohen. It's from a press conference after a lecture that he had delivered on. It was on a conference on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and U.S. strategy, and it was Senators Lugar, Nunn, and Cohen, while he was Secretary of Defense, delivering this presentation on these threats in 1997, so before the 9/11 event. And this is what he said in the press conference that followed, and I'm just going to read a one-liner. And it says, and I quote, "Others are engaging in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. That's from a seated Secretary of Defense speculating on what might be possible. When you think about that, what does that tell you about the state of our own technology? To evaluate someone else's, you have to have the basic science. The idea of creating instabilities became a big issue in the earth-penetrating tomography applications I was describing earlier, and a guy named Brooks Agnew, who was a specialist in this area, he'd actually done some work for a company most of us know about now, Halliburton, where he had actually taken a system that he had developed out to 26 well sites in 9 different states where the ground strata was known, and he used 30 watts of power, very, very little energy. But he manipulated that energy in such a way that he got a reflected signal coming back that gave him the ability to analyze the ground strata. And with a great deal of accuracy, 99% accurate, he was able to not only differentiate the ground strata and match it against those original drill logs where the information was actually known, and map that strata using very, very little energy. And what he said, and his concern was, that the kind of energy that HARP was planning on utilizing could, in fact, trigger instabilities rather than just detect layers of ground. And so this becomes a big issue. There's still a lot to be said in terms of research that needs to be done in that area to see if that really could work. But when you start to see high-ranking government officials expressing concerns about unsophisticated terrorist states having this kind of technology, tells you a lot about the technology. It tells you, first of all, that it's relatively flat. It tells you, secondly, that most of the components have to be off the shelf because it has to be something available. And thirdly, is the concepts behind that technology have to be generally understood by lots of people for them to express concern about terrorist organizations having that kind of capability. When we're talking about manipulation of environmental systems, complete environmental systems, whether it's HARP, coupling to the machine on the earth, changing its character as if it were just another cog in the wheel, is a very wrong approach, and one that our traditional allies in Europe have taken offense to from the standpoint that no country owns the ionosphere, and no country should be allowed that kind of experimentation without a whole lot of oversight. And that oversight is not taking place. One of the other things that came up in a lot of the dialogue was sort of this direction of non-lethal weapons and sort of where that goes, which I've alluded to a little bit. But because this conference is primarily oriented towards environment, I want to talk about another major area of importance in terms of environmental systems being affected by new weapons applications. And many have heard, and just to get an idea of how many have heard, about the new low-frequency sonars used by the Navy. Okay, it's kind of mixed. Let me talk a little bit about that, because most have also heard that there was a lawsuit that was settled and everything is rosy, but I want to give you the background on this. You remember a number of years ago there was a beaching of whales in the Bahamas. Caused all kinds of controversy, and it was a multi-species beaching, which most people, you know, look at skeptically right off the bat, because when it involves a number of species, these are extremely rare, and almost in every instance they've been associated with military exercises taking place in the areas going back to the mid-1960s. What happened with this issue is we touched on it when there was an incident in the Mediterranean. We touched on it in Earth Rising anecdotally. We referenced it. We referenced the scientists and said, basically, look, this is something we need to be watching for. One of the folks that had read some of our work, a woman named Marcia Green from the Marine Mammals Institute, contacted me and said, would you consider coming to a conference in Bar Harbor, Maine, University of the Atlantic, I believe was the place. And it was sponsored by one of the commissioners of the Marine Mammal Commission. And they wanted to bring together all of the environmental organizations to look at this sonar, this new sonar, and its effect in the seas. The thing that happened in the Bahamas that was extremely valuable was on the beach where zoologists from Harvard, when those whales came ashore. So they immediately took the heads, sent them up to Harvard, had them analyzed, and they determined that what they had died from was hemorrhaging. And so then they began to look at, okay, what was the cause of that hemorrhaging? And at the time in this area, they were using not these low-frequency sonars. They were using a mid-range sonar that's essentially deployed all over the oceans of the world today. I mean, these are sonars that are out there. The Navy eventually, being challenged on it, eventually acquiesced and said the only conclusion, and they delivered a study, and we cite the study, and their only conclusion was that they were responsible for this event. And actually, we took a chapter and dedicated it in this last and latest book, Earth Rising 2, on the sonars, because it's such an important issue. And when Marcia called me, I said, you know, what do you want me to present at this conference? I said, I don't really know anything about sonars. She goes, no. She goes, I want you to broaden the dialogue for the environmental community to deal with the impacts of new weapons technologies that are on the horizons, that are emerging, because nobody understands this stuff. Everyone's worrying about the traditional things that environmentalism has attacked, oil spills, deforestation, those kinds of issues. But this issue has the potential of impacting everything. So she said, come present on electromagnetic weapon systems, present on HAARP, and then use this as an opportunity to learn about sonars, and then perhaps you can get this story out in ways that we couldn't. What happened in all of that is a way that energy operates in the seas in terms of sound is much, much different than in the air. For instance, you're hearing my voice right now, and 99.97% of the energy in that transfer as it strikes your body is reflected. Only 0.03% is absorbed into tissue and not very deep unless it's a really low frequency signal that you guys all know about, right? Bull, 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 when you're driving down the road, the car next door, maybe it's your car. But the point is, you know, the energy basically is reflected. In the seas, it operates much, much differently. In the seas, when a sound wave travels and strikes tissue, 100% of the energy is absorbed into that tissue until it reaches a cavity, a gas pocket, an air pocket, the lungs of humans or marine mammals, where the energy is released explosively, causing massive hemorrhaging. That would equate to what the Navy said was the real thing was these animals had the bends from coming up too fast. That was their story. Because the effect appears the same. You get the same effect. But, you know, these animals surface at very rapid rates for all kinds of reasons, and that's never been in the mix. But this is the equation. Marine mammals communicate using sound. You know, in the air, when we're talking about radio frequency signals, you know, shortwave, the way that sound, radio frequency transmission travels around the Earth, and gets converted back to sound, that becomes a bounce between the ionosphere, this layer I described earlier in the Earth, where the signal bounces and goes around the curvature and you can pick it up. In the seas, the things that regulate sound in the seas is salt levels, which vary with depth, and temperature. So there's a band where that sound gets trapped and it bounces and can carry very long distances with very little energy behind it. That's the way marine mammals, like whales, communicate over hundreds and hundreds of miles. It's the whisper of nature. And man, we always come in, we think the bigger deal is, why dust with a feather when we got a sledgehammer? You know, and that's how we apply natural observations initially, usually with the sledgehammer approach. Well, bigger must be better. And so this approach, when it was beginning to be tested, they started having these incidents of multi-species beachings. And the important thing here is the military totally ignored the environmental impact statement process until they were challenged by a group in Hawaii and California with a lawsuit that said, hey, wait a minute, you've been testing this all over the seas, and there's no environmental impact statement. The thing that happened in that is it forced that issue. The military then pulled back and said, well, we're not going to do anything. So the lawsuit kind of died, and then it came back, resurrected again, and they say they settled it. They didn't settle anything, and I'll tell you why. They left a couple of big holes. One is they're still doing it in parts of Asia as a part of that settlement. It's accepted. And in wartime. Does anybody know what time it is? According to this administration. You know, we're in it. So a settlement in wartime when there's a question of whether we're in it or not, and this administration is going to view that liberally, we're in a war, they're exempt. The other important thing in the appropriations legislation this last time, there was an attempt to attach as a rider. This is a very important issue because riders get attached by very powerful people to sidestep the public process of legislation. And there was a rider attached to exempt the military and the House side from all environmental regulation. Now, I don't believe that hung on, but it's going to come back around again. And this, when you look at the biggest polluters in the world, it's our military and other militaries. When you look at the sites, the cleanup, in my part of the world, a lot of it's isolated, but you can go down the Aleutian chain and it's a garbage dump from one end to the other because of what the military did there in World War II. You know, it's never been cleaned up. When you start talking about systems that affect entire global systems, which is where our technology is going, these guys need to be reined in and we need to look at what's happening. Now, I'm not saying disclose the national secrets. You know, in all the work that I've done with thousands of documents, I've never touched a classified record. And mainly because I don't need to, and I don't want to go to jail and fight that battle when I've got other things to do, which is getting this information out. There's lots in the open literature. What happens in a lot of this is the open literature carries it so far, and then these projects go black. And what does that mean? It means that essentially nobody knows, except those doing the program, what's involved, except for a handful of selected senators and representatives that might get a piece of that information in a closed hearing. But those closed hearings, there's no experts there besides the experts selling the program. There's no challenge. There's no ability to challenge. And I'm not saying we should know all the national secrets on how to build this stuff. But conceptually, we ought to be in a position to have the debate about the concepts themselves. Should we apply these concepts? Should we interfere with weather systems? Should we, as a matter of policy, do these kinds of things? And, you know, when you start to think about it commercially, Soviets have been offering, the Russians now, offering countries and individuals their weather control technologies. You know, this has been offered. I got a call in the last couple of months from, I believe it was a big paper in Fort Worth. I think it was the Examiner, but I might have that wrong. And they were interviewing me on a Russian company that was going to do a weather modification project for a local government in South Texas that wasn't getting enough rain. And so they wanted to contract with this company, bring them in and get some rain. And, you know, you might, if you live in that neighborhood, you might think that's a great idea, except the downstream effects, which cannot be modeled, can be quite dramatic and quite different than what you expect. And so weather modification as a concept, if companies and individuals feel like this is something they can do because there is no regulation, and they begin doing this in various places, it's going to create even a more chaotic system than the one that we've been observing for the last 20 years, getting more and more intense as the Earth demonstrates its inability to cope with whatever is happening, whether it's a combination of natural events and man-made events. But what we're adding on to this is technology now designed specifically for manipulating and interfering with those very systems that all of us depend on for life. And it's being done in a classified environment. In the late 90s, 40% of the Air Force budget, as an example, were for black projects. You know, that's no scrutiny, no accountability. When you think about equipment budget in the Air Force, 40% of it going for things no one gets to see, that is a huge, huge amount of money. The nature of our work started to shift a little bit in the last few years. We started dealing with technology in a broader basis and not just talking about HAARP, although it always comes back. And you know, and mainly I speak to groups with a lot more gray hair than I see in this room, which is, you know, and I'm glad to see it, because if this has been missed, I think, by activists. And when you combine this combination of young activists with elder experienced folks, I think you get the best dynamic for creating social and political change. Always has been. And it's a big missing piece. In Europe, we had that piece engaged, and it creates a lot of impetus for discussion and change. This issue and issues connected to it, you know, we've been featured on CBC, Fuji TV, Spiegel TV, Telemundo, BBC, just as examples, and yet in the U.S. we cannot get visibility on these issues. And it's unfortunate in the sense that these are the issues the military openly talks about. A good document I recommend heavily that you find it and read it, because it really sets the stage for this revolution. And it's called The Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, U.S. Army War College. You can get it through interlibrary loan, and I'm sure you've got that available here as well. It's a revolution of military affairs and conflict short of war, and it's produced by the U.S. Army War College, and I believe the date is 1990 or 89. And what this document did is start to set the stage for this change in the way wars would be fought. And what they said in this, going back 1989, 1990 time frame, they said, the changes that are coming are going to be so dramatic that they'll conflict with traditional American values in such a way that the American public would never allow them to be instituted, except under a condition of fear. And what they did in this paper is they said, first of all, what kind of systems are we talking about? And this, we're off the HAARP subject, all right? So we're talking about just general systems, things that they were concerned about. One of them was an EMP weapon, electromagnetic pulse weapon. This is a weapon that creates a surge of energy that attacks electronic circuits. So it causes bit errors in computers. It causes, at high energy densities, can actually melt circuitry. But you need a lot of energy for that. For just disrupting our modern electronics, you don't need so much. In fact, you can take the energy. This was written up in the LA Times and the sites in Earth Rising Revolution, but it was you could take the energy from two car batteries, as an example, to standard car batteries, run that energy into a capacitor bank, in other words, draw the energy off and store it in capacitors, and then if you release that energy in 150 billionth of a second, which is what this guy did, it creates the same energy level for that 150 billionth of a second, exceeding what the United States produces in energy. So you think about it, because what you're doing is you're taking it and then you're releasing it at a very, very quick rate. And so the amount of energy released at that very short instant of time is significant. And what it does is causes disruptions in large areas. They've developed smaller scale systems for police forces. Some of you may have seen stories on this where they point it at a car and it affects the electronic ignition and causes a car to stop functioning, as an example. And then the larger scale would deal with things that would cover a battle environment and knock out electronics over a large area, which for modern armies and militaries is a big deal. For the unsophisticated militaries, it's not such a big deal. EMP was a big concern of the Soviets, which is why they continue to manufacture vacuum tubes as a way around it in some of their more sophisticated backup systems, because they couldn't be easily disrupted with this kind of surge of energy. When you think about it, the way they talked about it, they said, well, you know, we could use this against international terrorists or drug traffickers. Remember, 1989, before 9/11 and any of this stuff. And we could actually target their planes and knock them out of the sky, and they'd crash, and there'd be, you know, pilot error, no residual damage. You know, you just create bit errors on the avionics that control that flight. Then there was this discussion about, you know, what about juries and judges and convictions and presumptions of innocence and all those wonderful things that get in the way of military actions, but the rest of us kind of rely on as basic principles. And they engage in this discussion within this military paper where they say, maybe those constitutional provisions don't apply once we leave the boundaries of the United States. That is a very dangerous position. Again, overlaying these other concepts in modern warfare. The idea a constitution doesn't roll with our military, what the heck are they defending when they leave the boundaries of this country? That is what they're defending. That constitution, the objective is to pass those basic values to others, not ignore them when you leave your doorstep. That is not what this country was ever about, and that's what this paper was suggesting is in fact the case. What they went further, they didn't stop there. They started talking about a new technology within this paper for GPS, being able, geographic positioning system, being able to locate people with precision, and they were talking about using an implantable technology for service personnel going into the battlefield. First time I've ever seen an implantable technology openly discussed in military literature. And what they said was this would be used for monitoring troop movements within a battle environment so that you'd know where all your equipment was positioned and where all your manpower was, because you'd be able to monitor them within a meter on the battlefield. And if you think about it, if you're in the military and you're going into combat, you might not want to say no to that option. I mean, if you get captured, it'd be nice for them to be able to find you with a level of precision. Well, the microcircuits are much better today. Now they can actually monitor heart rate, stress levels, a lot of biological functions, so you get not just where these people are, but what condition they're in within that battle environment. But they didn't stop there. The military said, this would be really handy for business travelers, because after all, we're in a volatile world and we need this in case there's a problem, we've got to get our people out. Of course, we won't turn it on unless there's a problem. And if anybody believes that, there's a bridge out here that I got for sale. The fact is, they abuse their power all of the time until they get caught, and then they back off for a little while until they get caught again, or they transfer it to somebody else and let them do it as their surrogates. A lot of things happen with private companies now because they're exempt from certain laws like the Freedom of Information Act. You can't get information on companies doing the dirty work, only the agencies that are doing the dirty work. And only a certain amount, and under this administration, they've even constrained that. And they've given people who do the kind of research that I do, they've given us a new name, now they call us accumulators and we're in the villain group because they consider us a national security risk. We used to be called investigative reporters, because we dig out the information, put it out. Unlike reporters, say, working for the New York Times, where they got a big bank of lawyers, if I had that, I might use some classified documents from time to time and get away with it. But I'm not interested in that because you don't need it to make the points. The other thing this document went on to say, because it didn't stop there, it said, these would all be great technologies if we could apply them, but Americans will oppose them. It's against American traditional values. Now, that's where you think the paper should end, right? Americans don't like it, it's military, we end it, but they didn't. They then went into two fictional scenarios where that would change. And they said the fictional scenarios were two. One, create international terrorism concerns to the point in which people are engaged in an environment of fear where they'll trade off what they believe is safety and security in exchange for civil liberties. The second thing they said, the second possibility, was international drug traffickers being villainized to the point where that became such a threat, again, fear-driven, that would allow people to give up civil liberties in exchange for having those problems dealt with. If you look at the PSAs today running on television, they link those two things together. This is not an accident, folks. Military plans for every possible contingency except one that they can't plan for, they never figured out how to plan for, and that's called spontaneous revolution. And I'm not talking about violent revolution. I'm talking about what happened in Eastern Europe, in the Philippines, and other places when people one day wake up and say, we're not doing this anymore. There is no defense against that because there is no head. There is no leadership to take out. There is no one to preempt unless you preempt the whole population. Those revolutions work very effectively, and we've seen them in our lifetimes. That's what they cannot deal with. But here's what happens in this paper. They create this scenario where you increase fear levels, and then you bring in these technologies, and that is exactly what has happened since 9/11. Some people have said, well, it was a conspiracy, 9/11. I don't buy into that. What I buy into is this. It was an opportunity, not a conspiracy. Once the event occurred, it wasn't like the plan had to be written. It was already written. It had to be executed, and it was. And what did you see? The Patriot Act? How many local governments have opposed the Patriot Act across this country? Over 150 now. And yet, 200 now. And yet, what do we got? no change in the law. Now, has your congressman mentioned to you that he really regretted or she really regretted doing it? Well, ours have, but they haven't introduced new legislation to change it. You know, and ours are pretty powerful. You know, we got the chairman of appropriations in the Senate, Stevens from Alaska. He hasn't done anything, and he certainly could. He does a lot by rider, you know, in our state, in terms of getting things done. The point is, they haven't made a change. And if you look at the law, they'll say, oh, yeah, but it has sunset provisions. It's going to sunset, and everybody's rosy about that. But look at the law. There are certain provisions within the law that do not sunset. And one of them is anyone on their list of people that are suspected of being opposed to national policy. Well, that's everybody in here. Because everybody in here has opposed national policy at one point or another in our lives. And that is the American tradition that every one of us, no matter whether we agree or disagree on a lot of this, can stand behind and really agree on. That's what's being interfered with. The idea of manipulation from the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial academic complex, I think is more appropriately today, is what Eisenhower warned about and is what has happened to us and is happening to us now. There was supposed to be a peace dividend. Where is it? It doesn't exist because there never was an intention of giving us one. The money is being reallocated in the biggest welfare system ever, and it's a corporate welfare system. The military spends more money, if you take out the entitlement programs, than all the other government agencies combined. You know, that is a huge, huge amount of productive wealth. And in the course of this, when we presented testimony at the European Parliament in 98 on this whole issue, and it was February 5th, 1998, when we presented that testimony, the one thing we said is we said the United States would unilaterally abrogate the ABM treaty on the basis that the argument would be made in the Congress. We said that there is no Soviet Union and therefore there is no agreement. That was a year before it happened. We predicted, actually it was 9 months before it happened. We predicted it would be a year. And it was the one point out of all the points we made that the committee took exception to. Because they could not fathom the United States moving this direction without their involvement. 9 months later, when it was announced in the Federal Register that we were in fact headed that way, that is what accelerated our ability to get our resolutions passed. But it also set the stage for questioning what our government was doing with its traditional allies. And this is a huge, huge mistake to exclude traditional allies. Because just because we're on top of technology today does not mean we're going to be on top of that technology tomorrow. Every place where we have conflict is where we've interfered with someone else's domestic politics. Whether it's in Iran, Iraq, or Afghanistan, these places are all places where we've manipulated their political outcomes. We got people angry at us because of that manipulation. Manipulation we would never stand for in this country. Should we expect others to stand for it in their own? And the answer is no. Either our values travel with us or they travel against us. And today they're traveling against us because those making policy are doing it for not our interests, but for the interests that pay the bills. Things we used to call bribery, now we call a campaign contribution. The effect is exactly the same. It is exactly the same. When you think about what does bribe get you? It gets you access, it gets you opportunity, and it gets you the ability to influence a policymaker. Go in and try and see your U.S. senator or U.S. congressman. And if you're lucky, you'll get ushered in for 30 seconds, get a photo shoot, and be ushered back out the door. Drop a check at the front counter for $5,000 for the contribution for that year and ask them for a luncheon appointment. I'll guarantee you'll get one. That's bribery. It's not a contribution when that's what it gets you. And that's what we've allowed to happen within the country. And at this point, so much is being driven by that military-industrial complex and those that benefit by it, that who are the losers? You know, the big losers, you know, the Halliburton scandal recently, you know, the overcharge on fuel. People are going, well, you know, an overcharge on fuel, you know, how can that be? It's $1 a gallon overcharge on fuel. You know, I mean, that's something that you just don't make a clerical error on. When they traced it out, it turns out the company's related to the royal family, and it's another bribe. And who do they have looking at that to make sure that it wasn't done corruptly? The Pentagon. You know, it's just send the fox into the chicken coop and make the count. You know, it's not going to work. And it's that lack of accountability is the big issue. The next thing that happened with our efforts in Europe on this, Tom Spencer took it on. And he was, when we finished our testimony in the hearing, State Department sent someone over for 2 weeks going to every political person that was in that room, whether they were active on the committee or sitting in the audience, and tried to influence their perception of what we were doing by discrediting our work and discrediting us. Which is, you know, politicians understand this. I grew up in it. I understand it. Is if you can't deal with the issues, you try and attack the individual. But politicians know this game, so they didn't buy in. And they also didn't know, or weren't, their intelligence wasn't as effective as it should have been, because they should have known we'd already been there a half a dozen times. We had spent time with each of these people, and we delivered, by the time we went into testimony, 3 feet of documents that had been analyzed by their research teams and put into briefing papers for these folks. And they weren't our words, they were our government's words, where our allies were not clued in public literature. That is strategically a disaster. Now you introduce these new concepts where I started, preemptive warfare, the idea of wiping someone out because you think they might do something, that violates every traditional value in this country about innocence and guilt from a fundamental level. Then you add into that speed of light weapon systems that can take that adversary out in the twinkling of an eye. What happens when our adversaries develop those same systems and target us? Will they? I think they will. Again, we can't abandon those traditional values because they drive everything. And that's what's happened in the last 10 years. This revolution in military affairs is a revolution against humanity. It's a revolution against every one of us in this room, and every one of us in this room are paying for it in multitudes of ways. The end result is it's a degradation of what happens environmentally, it's a degradation of what happens socially, and it's a limit on what's possible in terms of human potentials. That's what's being missed. When we engaged this effort in Alaska, people said, you know, you're so far removed, you know, how are you going to impact this? There were two of us. There's still two of us. People said, you should organize, you know, you should organize a group, organize an event. I don't organize groups, because this is the organization I'm a part of, and the one that you're a part of, and the one that's already organized. It's the organic internet, it's called the human race, and we don't need to organize anything else. We just need to act on what we know to be right and true and begin to do something about it. And that's not in some big way necessarily. In fact, probably it's not. It's, you know, I used to contemplate as a young person what faith was, you know, and it was supposed to be this big mystery. You know what it is in simple terms for me? It's knowing something internally and stepping into it with an action that furthers what it is that you are internalizing. Externalize it. That's the act of faith, stepping into what you know to be right and true and acting on it. And being big enough and smart enough so that if you get in trouble on the idea, that you can back off, accept your mistakes, grow from that, and move forward. And everyone in the room with a little bit of gray hair knows one thing. Where do we learn the best? Where do we learn the most? Where do we learn the things that impacted our lives in the most dramatic way? It was in the disasters that hit us in life, not on those rosy moments. So, you know, even stepping into it, you run into things. But this is what I've said to people all around the country is, pick an issue that's near and dear to your heart. Do what you know you can do about that issue. Not what you think you can do, but what you absolutely, positively know you can do, and that is your sphere of influence at the moment. And what you will find in following each step along that route is you'll look back at a trail you never thought you would travel. Everyone in this room has the potential to do way more than I ever did, way more than anyone else has ever done. Every major change in the world has happened by one or two people saying, I don't quite see it the same way, and acting on it. And in conclusion, that's my message to everyone in this room, is find those issues that are important to you, act on those issues, and you will change the world. You'll change the way the world is perceived, and you'll change the way people perceive it. And you can do that one bite at a time, or you can do it talking to 5 million people on a radio show one evening. But the fact is, you can do it if you act on what you know. And with that, I'll conclude and take some questions for the next 20 minutes. You know, I've heard this speculated, but, you know, again, there's nothing I've seen in the literature, and this has been the big hallmark of our work, is if we can't footnote it with independent sources, we don't speculate on it. And in this case, there's been others that have, you know, speculated exactly this kind of effect. One of the people I respect in this mix was a guy, Brooks Agnew, who I mentioned earlier, being involved in earth-penetrating tomography. One of his concerns was actually creating a shunt, where the energy going up actually is like a conductor. so that you send it up into the ionosphere, and then all of a sudden you're acting as a conduit for that energy to come down to the Earth. And he said if that actually happened, what you would see is the biggest bolt of lightning you've ever seen in your life striking the Earth 40 times a second until that shunt of that conduit was broken or else the energy was discharged. You know, that's an incredible image in terms of what that would do. It solved the heart problem for a few moments, but it might create a lot of other problems on the side. And his area of concern was creating instabilities within the Earth itself. You know, a lot of the stuff when you're looking at in this area, when they're monitoring some of these volcanoes in the area, they note low-frequency signals before there's eruptions. In some earthquake areas, they note low-frequency signals before there's eruptions. The question is, you know, and then they look at the Great Alaskan earthquake where you had an earthquake on the ground and ionospheric disturbance in the air. There's some kind of a relationship that we do not yet understand, nor the full mechanism. So are these things possible? Or that's probably in the mix of possibility. But again, without the hard literature, I couldn't say with certainty. The second question. All right. As long as everybody knows the speculation. I have not read that one yet. I've read reviews, but not read the book. On the issue of the discovery, you know, again, it's people speculating in that area. Could you do something like this with modern technology? The answer is yes. The technologies I've described in many instances could be targeted against electronics, particularly something as complicated as a space shuttle. Was it? That is speculation. Is it possible? The thing that Bernard Eastland alerted me to that I became very concerned about when I had dinner with him a few weeks back was one particular frequency range he's asked me to look at and see if they're playing with it, because it's to accelerate electrons in the ionosphere in a way that would literally knock out huge numbers of communication satellites simultaneously. This is from his perspective, they actually inadvertently create that event, we've got huge problems, because without those communication systems, our economies start to take some huge hits. But again, it's in the realm of, even in Ben's is more based on the science. He knows if they operate in this range, this is the effect. Anti-satellite technology, remember when I was talking about heating the ionosphere? The Strategic Studies Institute brought this issue up, because if you heat it up and you push this atmosphere into space that isn't supposed to have atmosphere, and a low orbiting satellite traverses that space, encounters friction, it breaks up, the object crashes. As an anti-satellite technology, the Russian take on it went a little further. They said, you know, when objects come in from space, you know, asteroids, comets, you know, most of them break up before they ever hit the Earth. But you only have about 30 miles, you know, for the friction to occur to break things up. What happens if you could project and calculate the trajectory and push that atmosphere instead of 30 miles, give it 200 miles of distance to break up? You could break up a lot larger objects and create some solutions. Now, there may be reasons to consider that, you know, as a trade-off versus the impact of some large object on the planet. But those are things that scientists, very serious scientists, consider credible when it comes to this type of technology. And again, in that instance, somebody has to decide the collateral damage issues. Somebody has to say, okay, how many people will I lose this way versus how many people will I lose that way? The problem is the people making those decisions usually aren't anyone we elected, and usually aren't anyone that we would have a great deal of confidence in making humanitarian decisions on our behalf. So, because the motivations are different. And this is, again, where there's this lack of accountability, lack of scrutiny. The root of these problems are a security syndrome that's gotten way out of control to cover what should not be hidden in darkness, but what would be standing in the light of the day, because many of these politicians would be gone if we knew the abuses. A good example in Earth Rising Revolution, one chapter is dedicated to military experimentation in the U.S. Secretary of Energy O'Leary acknowledged over 500,000 Americans have been victims of human experimentation in the United States over 40 years when she was Secretary of Energy. 500,000 Americans, and this involved everything from Native Americans in Alaska being injected with radioactive iodine to blacks in the South being given syphilis. I mean, just horrendous kinds of things. You know, not one single solitary person has been held to account for that. No one's been brought to trial. No one has been challenged on that. They belong in jail. They belong under the jail. In fact, they're protected. When you do the FOIAs, the Freedom of Information Act request, they blank out all the academic names, all the scientists' names. You can't get any of that information. people who morally belong under the jail. You had a question. There's lots in literature. I mean, Psychology Today took on the ethics question of manipulation of the human brain as an issue because the technology a number of years ago reached the level of discussion where it made it into the popular press. The Economist took on the same issue. The issue's driven enough. There's enough in the scientific literature. There's enough out there to say, yeah, this you can do. The question is, are they doing it? And that's really the only question right now. And when you look at their own literature about their own experiments, the answer is yes to that too. They say it's consensual, but whenever you're in new areas of scientific research, there's a lot of unknowns. So what are you consenting to? Part you know and part you don't. And that's part of the problem in all this. It tends to be the disadvantaged that are used in these experiments, prisoners, minority groups, people that are the marginalized in terms of society. And even the military themselves, the biggest victims of all. And, you know, these people, if they object, they go to the brig. You know, they don't get to complain. That's where we have to complain. You know, the anthrax vaccine was a good example of this. You know, military didn't get a vote on that. You know, they just got to do it. These people risk their lives once. If they decide that's a risk twice, why should they have to take that second risk? It's up to us to advocate for them. Because in those strategic times when we need that military to do the work that the rest of us have not been called to do, we want to know that they are fighting for the same basic values that we are. And that means that we have to make sure that their values are intact as well. That the things that they can't speak about for themselves, that we advocate for them. And this is not happening on a scale that it ought to. You know, these guys are pawns in the game. They're not the game makers. You know, we need to be compassionate and considerate of the fact that these people are human beings like us, probably don't really want to be there, but do it because they have to. And then we add additional risk to them, and I think this is a horrible situation. In the case of the mainstream media, there's some good things coming out of this that I think are pretty exciting. In terms of the understanding of the human brain, the school district in Minneapolis Public School District, set up a charter school a number of years ago, and they're using a technique called neurobiofeedback or brain biofeedback, and some may be familiar with this. They're taking attention deficit disorder kids or hyperactive kids that operate in too low of a range or too high of a range, and if you look at the brain, you break it down for basic human interactions. You've got a delta state, which is about 1 to 4 hertz, pulses per second, vibrations per second. This is where you are when you're in your deepest, deepest states of sleep. The next level is theta, which is about 4 hertz to 7 hertz, more or less. This is where you are when you're between awake and asleep, when you're actively participating in your dreams consciously. This is also where kids are between the age of 3 and 5 for the most of their time, which explains a lot. Yeah. I have 5 kids. My youngest is 10 and my oldest is 26, so I totally understand what I'm talking about here. Is they really, you know, they're kind of like, they can't distinguish, you know, reality from fiction and imagination. It's because where their brain is at that point in development. Now, some parents get all excited and all uptight. This is normal, natural, it's okay. Educating kids at the young age where we take that away from them is very damaging and destructive in the long run. Europeans know this. That's why they don't start them in school till they're around 7. You know, they don't start them at 3 like we do in preschools and all this stuff. The next stage, alpha, this is where you are when you're in the zone, whether you're an artist, an intellectual, an athlete, that's that alpha range, when you're right in sync with where you need to be for creative work and intellectual work. And then there's the better range, which is where I hope I've got most of you unless I put a few to sleep. And what happens is, again, external fields manipulating. In Minneapolis, what they found is that the hyperactive kids ran too high. A lot of the attention deficit disorder kids ran too low, and they couldn't get into this ideal state, so we drug them up with Ritalin and a bunch of psychoactive drugs, and this is all supposed to solve the problem. And it doesn't. It does other damage, and other problems get created. They set up a charter school using brain biofeedback. They put on these, they used to have these really greasy EEG setups where you got 16 electrodes glued to your head. Kids weren't really excited about that. So they developed these helmets, you know. They look like a bicycle helmet or a kind of a space helmet. So they're kind of cool, and they got the kids on the machine looking at the computer, and they might have like a bouncing ball. And the objective is using just their brain to get the ball to bounce in a certain range. 30 to 40 sessions of an hour each in that charter school, by the end of the year, 80% of the population was off of all psychoactive substances, and they were able to modulate their brain activity into that ideal state of learning. And this is an active program in Minneapolis today because it took kids off of psychoactives to to get them to where they could modulate their brain activity in a more efficient way than most of us can, because they learn the technique. That's the application of some of this knowledge that is not migrating as rapidly. This is knowledge the military's had for 20 years, and it's finally making it into school systems that should have been in there 20 years ago. I mean, you look at, what does that mean if you don't have anyone that you know that's in that area? One day you're going to pay the taxes for that public school, and to educate special ed kids is 2, 3, and 4 times, sometimes 10 times more than the average student. So if you can solve the underlying problem from the humanitarian perspective, and then from just a pure economic perspective, look at the result, that is a benefit to everyone, except the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, and that's a whole other story for another day, but the point is, you know, there's a lot of influences over what gets into the mainstream scientific community, which is what your question was really getting at. It has happened. It is there. It's a question now. The debate is internal, because a lot of these same people having the debate are people who've traded off their values to be exploited by military for the development of these systems. The other thing that's happened is in the course of patents, patents are routinely confiscated by the military. And every patent you file is scrutinized by every intelligence and military intelligence group in the country for security applications. And if they find them, and I know scientists who have lost their intellectual property in this way, if they find an application, they take the patent and they suppress it, doesn't make it into the public domain. They go to the scientists and they say, you cannot work on this project. Talk about this to anyone. We want a list of everyone you've ever talked to about it. We want all of your research work. And if you want to do any more of this, you got to do it in our labs. And the alternative is treason. Okay, that's the alternative to violating that order. And then the problem for the scientist is they can't even go out and do a market study to figure out what they've invented is worth, because they can't talk to anybody about it. You know, that's, again, where a lot of things get screened out without scrutiny and accountability. There is none. You know, what are national security issues today? We're not just talking about warfare. Economic issues are national security issues today. If you created a technology that would replace oil, that's a national security issue. And under this administration, oil would win, because this administration is vested in that industry. They took the biggest bribe of all. Cheney's $20 million on his way out of Halliburton. Yeah. Yeah, to respond to that, militaries, you know, they want to accuse everyone else that attacks them in terms of policy-wise as paranoid. Militaries are the best paranoids in the business, because that's their job, to be paranoid, figure out every possible disaster. Yeah, and it is a lot of male thinking. I agree with you on that. I work in something that wasn't mentioned in my bio. I'm a tribal administrator for Chicolin Village, which is a matriarchy, traditional matriarchy in Alaska. And the view of the world is certainly much different from that view. And I think there's a lot to be said for more women getting engaged in these particular kinds of areas, which, when you look at how women are treated in schools, they tend to go away from the technology areas. And that's something that's changing in this generation, but it's long overdue. Politically, it's the same. When you talk about sort of the male approach to it, I think you're right. You know, I mean, males tend to be more aggressive. That's just a fact of nature. Well, I don't know what you mean by obsolete. I mean, are they no longer effective? If you mean that they're no longer effective, I would argue with that, because they are effective if your objective is to annihilate someone. If your objective is to change political systems, I would agree with you, they're not effective at all, because all we do is create multi-generational adversaries, and that's what we're doing. We're doing the same thing that has happened in so many other parts of the world, where it's not just an event that people can kind of go, okay, it's justified. It's the way that we're approaching things without real justification, without the kind of levels, the controls of what basic human instincts are about, which says, you know, we really shouldn't be killing each other. Do I think it's going to end? Not in our lifetimes, unfortunately. I think we're going to see, you know, a lot of time to reconcile this globalization effort, which is really economic. It's about money and creating markets. And another effort happening sort of on the aside, and I participated in lots of international conferences as both a speaker and a participant, and the thing that's changed is this, and this I think is fundamental to what can happen, is when we quit going in and making assumptions based on our value set about other people, we will start in the right direction. As an example, the first Catholic bishop of Brazil was in a conference with me, and we were talking about this idea of poverty and happiness and the equation between the two. And we go into an area as Westerners and say, oh, isn't this horrible? It's terrible. You know, look at all these poor people. But if you really look at what's going on within those cultures, we probably ought to leave them alone. Because what is going on that's inherent there is, generally speaking, until we get involved, there's a level of social order, cultural structure, a general sense of happiness within a population. What changes that is industrialization that moves rural people into urban areas and then creates all the problems that springs from it. We believe in way we believe has been misapplied, and it's not just the United States. It's UNESCO acknowledged this recently as a mistake to impose values on others. It's better to go into areas, find out what's indigenous to the area, and see if we can amplify that and correspond with it. And if we can't correspond with what's indigenous to the area, we should get the hell out of there. We don't belong there. It's not our place. That's the mistake we make. It's the arrogance of the West believing that we have the best plan. You know, we go 500 years back, and what we did to this hemisphere, to this part of the world, was on that same basic premise that, well, we know better. Even amongst, you know, within American culture today, Alaska is one of the last places where the indigenous remember what it was like to be abused. And I was having a conversation with someone coming into this. The humanity that's possible from that view, you know, the American system of government started with the Iroquois. We didn't import this from Europe. We adopted something indigenous to this country and spent 200 years screwing it up. And we lost that sensitivity to human beings. That's what we need to find. It's not male or female. It's human beings as our first priority. That's our obligation to one another, whether we live in this country or somewhere else. That change is going to take a change of this generation that's much more balanced than mine and the ones before me. And I think that's where the change has to be affected. And we're seeing more of it. You know, the problem is part of the model, the educational model, is flawed because it doesn't increase thinking. It makes factory workers. This institution, the way they develop their curriculums here, you essentially develop your own, as I understand it. That is a much different dynamic for learning, one that's much more acceptable to me. The technologies we've talked about, the right applications of them, whole brain coherence. I mean, probably everyone in this room has heard debates over right brain, left brain, which is more important. They were meant to work together. When they work together properly, you are potentially a fully actualized human being. Our system has allowed us to sort of put the energy on one side or the other. Now, because of sort of screwing up everyone equally, we shove it all in one direction versus the other, mostly left brain kind of thinking. The idea of technology augmenting human potential, that's the exciting part, and the part we really didn't get to explore very much of today, but that's the exciting part for me, because to deal with all of this, we have to have greater capacity. We have the capacity, we just haven't awakened it within ourselves. The technology that's on the horizon is here now, is awakening that potential. That's where real change can happen. As we waken up internally and express that externally, and as we wake up intellectually and express that more in a more balanced human way. I'll take one more question, then we'll close it off. This lady in the very back. All right. Those are both great points. Look, and for those who couldn't hear the questions, basically he's asking the non-lethal questions. Are they the non-lethal weapons? Are they really being deployed for all of this? And how are they being developed? And the second part of the question was dealing with, are they using it to sort of degrade the decision-making capacity, or at least create what I would say is create a drone out of a military personnel as opposed to somebody that's a thinking human being making good decisions. If you look at low-intensity conflict and modern technology, they actually speak to this point, and that's Maxwell Air Force Base, 1984. They also speak to sort of the flip side of it. Can we enhance what they call anomalous functions of the human being? These things that are mentioned in the literature but never really spoken about. You know, things that the military has acknowledged today, remote viewing, some of the ideas you're dealing with brain capacity that has been put in sort of the marginalized by the mainstream, but military has spent lots of money looking at how to create those kinds of effects for enhancing or at least neutralizing some of that decision-making or anxiety, you know, because basically that's it. You're going into war. Nobody goes into war with very, very, very few exceptions excited about killing people. So lowering the emotional anxiety, yeah, that's part of this whole concept, is you got to have people willing to pull the trigger. And you know, that's not easy for any human being to do. And anyone who's ever been to war will tell you that. That is a very, very difficult thing to do, no matter what the ideology is. Yeah. And actually, if you look at an EEG of a human being when they're experiencing negative emotions, fear, anxiety, all of these things, you'll see incoherent brain patterns that don't lend themselves to good, clean thinking. If you look at people experiencing higher emotions, love, compassion, you see very coherent, rhythmic brain patterns that are the kind of brain patterns necessary to making good decisions. So anything you do to increase fear levels decreases the ability to make good intellectual decisions, and we've seen it since 9/11 manifest in all areas of human engagement. The idea of stimulating fear, one of the weapons used in the first Gulf War was embedding a signal on radio broadcasts, which was reported by Scottish media, that created anxiety and fear on the part of our adversaries on the same channels they were listening to the Muslim prayers and music. We just embedded it on the signal. So then you have the fourth largest army in the world collapse like kids in their first fire drill. You know, you have to look at sort of why would an army like that collapse? They said, oh, we bombed them so heavily. Look at Dresden and London in World War II with civilian untrained populations being bombarded day in, day out for years, and you didn't see that. This, you know, this kind of interference for offensive systems or for your own systems, that is what it's all about. It's about controlling what this woman was speaking to, about controlling. If you can control the people within the battlefield, then you can control the outcomes with more precision. And it is about control, and it is about power, and it's about interfering with the right to be a human being in the fullest sense of who we are and taking that away from us, and that's what these systems are doing. And with that, I thank you all for being here. Thank you. Appreciate it.